Blog Talk Radio.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we don't have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we don't have to settle this another way.
Music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life. This is movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life.
Word.
Any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussy-footing, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay, or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy,
turn, I can never go back. Life without parole, upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole, looking at the world through a crack. Up that, I'd rather shoot it out and get clapped. I've gone too far, there ain't no coming back for me. Auschwitz gas chamber full of Zyklon B. Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos, raping the black and Indian women, creating Latinos. Motherfucker, up made me out of self-righteous hatred. And now you got yourself a virus, stuck in the matrix. A suicide bomber, strapped and ready to blow. Lethal injection, strapped down, ready to go. Don't you understand, they'll never let me live out in peace. Concrete jungle, guerrilla war out in the streets. Nat Turner with the sickle, pitchfork and machete. The end of the world, motherfucker, are you not ready?
DJ Tony Drake.
This is DJ Tony Drake, a.k.a. Mr. Top Self himself. And right now, you're in tune to Your World News, where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. Here on yourworldnews.org.
You can't tell me life was meant to be like this. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness. Ever since the Declaration of Independence, we've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence. It goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time there's violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred and prejudice. TV and the news for years they have fed you this foolish notion that blacks are all criminals, violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy.
Yes, that's DJ Tony Drake. That's the official Your World News intro. And my name is Solomon, and we'll be joined by with Andrea Zamudio for another edition of Your World News. We know it's been far too long since our last episode. It's been a good 2.5-3 weeks. And like I said, sometimes, you know, you just need a break. You know, imperialism, capitalism, white supremacy, institutional racism, you know, the myth of American exceptionalism, you know, sometimes they just have their toll on you and you got to retool, tune things up, continue to organize, and to continue to fight against these forces of evil, which means, you know, we need to mobilize and get out in our communities, one for all for one, and you know, not just stay behind, you know, our computer keyboards and just continue to type stories ad nauseum. You know, those of us that are writers and journalists, we have to get out there with the people because we are the people. That's what it's about, and that's why Your World News is a place where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. So we got a great episode for you today. I say it all the time, and every time I say it, every time episode I go ahead and I say that I say it all the time. But what we do, we have another great episode because we have another great guest, and that's what makes our shows good is the guests. Andrea and I just are facilitating space. We have Benjamin Woods, who's going to be joining us. Benjamin Woods is he's a grad student, a PhD candidate at Howard University, and he's one of the co-founders of SAMI, otherwise known as Students Against Mass Incarceration. He's going to be coming on the show and breaking down the whole derivation, the origins of SAMI, as well as SAMI TV, where they're getting out in the streets and they're interviewing folks in the Washington, D.C. community to talk about the prison industrial complex, to talk about mass incarceration, to talk about you know, how the police continue to prey and on their communities, these black communities, these African communities, you know, as if they were overseas, as if they were the Ku Klux Klan, you know, just trying to rain terror on these communities. And so he's going to be talking about a range of things and connecting the dots and talking about their most recent form that they had at Howard University. There was a form on the new Jim Crow, as you know, many of you know, that's a critically acclaimed book by scholar activist Michelle Alexander out of Ohio State, and this brilliant book that she wrote. I mean, it was a page turner. You really are stuck from page to page because it's compelling evidence that she has one page to the next page detailing the war on Black America and how the prison industrial complex has really played a major role in the destruction of the Black community, Black households, Black families, and what needs to be done to stop it. So Sammy and Benjamin Wood, they had a forum that was last week, and we're going to be talking about that with Benjamin Woods and a range of things. So I want to once again welcome on the show my co-host Andrea Zamudio, Miss Andrea Zamudio, and welcome her on, and then we're going to hit the ground running. Andrea, what are your thoughts? I mean, everything, there's so many different things going on. The U.S. and its NATO forces continue to rain bloody hell on Libya and the people of Libya, and you know, continue to fund these so-called rebels, these rebels that are acting just like the KKK. They're going through and they're lynching and cutting the breasts off and raping, you know, Black African women and lynching and, you know, and killing Black men and not a peep. And it was just interesting, most recently, Walter Fontre, the longtime civil rights activist that worked with Dr. Martin Luther King, he was in Libya and just got back, and he was in, you know, a few of these villages, and he saw NATO forces, you know, NATO forces that were behind, you know, some of the massacring that was going on. And, you know, basically, you know, he saw, you know, in this story that was in the Afro this past week, you know, talking about how he saw NATO forces doing things like beheading, you know, Libyans, and then blaming it on Gaddafi forces, and in some case blaming it, but putting the blame on rebel forces actually, and giving the rebel forces credit for it. I mean, and we know the rebel forces have been doing a lot of that anyways. But and he was there, and I think like his testimony is gonna be very, very telling within the coming days and weeks. But what you know, what are your thoughts for the day, Andrea, as we press forward?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
All right. You know, I mean, in terms of Libya, I just think that it's, you know, it's an extension of you know, all these imperialist wars that we've seen since 9/11, and it's not like it started with 9/11, but I think that there's been a lot of justification used because of 9/11 to invade North Africa and the Middle East, and so I think that it's a very sick and horrendous way to commemorate, you know, the lives of people that died on 9/11 in the U.S. By going off to other countries and killing even more innocent people. So, you know, that's, I know, you know, we didn't have a show yesterday, you know, speaking specifically about 9/11, but I think that a lot of it can be tied into what we're discussing today in terms of the prison industrial complex and with these wars abroad, the military industrial complex. And I'm just listening to, you know, some families who continue to grieve for their loss of people here speaking out and saying that, you know, it's really disgusting to see their government use their family members as, you know, as an excuse or as a justification to go murder more innocent people in countries that had nothing to do with what happened here on September 11th. Or either way, even if, you know, a specific group was involved from a specific country, it doesn't justify killing innocent people in that country. And so I've been, you know, really reflecting on that. And, you know, also the fact that there's a, and as I think there should be an emphasis on remembering the people that were lost in 2001. But, you know, the first September 11th was in 1973 in Chile, which the U.S., you know, was behind and in overthrowing the socialist president of Chile, Salvador Allende. And so there was also mass protests in Chile yesterday commemorating the 38th anniversary of that coup and the installation of the dictator, Augusto Pinochet, that was completely backed and supported by the U.S. government and the CIA.
Right, right. It definitely. And also, you know, killing great Chilean activists and freedom fighters like Miguel Enriquez of MIR, M-I-R, you know, and you know, we know that, yeah, this, who really, you know, he was even, you know, further left of the political sphere than Salvador Allende. And yeah, you know, it's, you know, Salvador Allende comes in there and wants to nationalize, you know, ITT and wins, you know, democratically elected, and we see, you know, Kissinger and everyone from Kissinger to Milton Friedman to the CIA to the Chicago Boys, you know, move into Chile, back, you know, these right wing forces and install Augusto Pinochet, and even they see what they do to Rene Schneider, who was the head of the military at that time. The CIA backed, you know, literally funded, paid, I believe it was something between $30,000 and $60,000. They paid these mercenary forces within Chile to go there, and they opened fire on his motorcade and killed him. Not instantly, he died, you know, 3 days later in the hospital. But this money, the cash payload, came directly from United States by way of the CIA, and murdered, you know, Rene Schneider. So, yeah, this, you know, the Chileans, you know, Americans may not know of America's dirty past, but the rest of the world does know. And it, you know, it's just interesting. You see, and yes, America. You know, Andre, I'm glad you brought that up, because just 9/11 in general, that you brought that up, because you look at all these different things that are going on. You know, you see the Jets Cowboys game, they did a commemoration. You saw the New York Mets Chicago Cubs game, they did a commemoration. It was across the board, and yes, there were a lot of Americans that died needlessly, and they were the victims of terror. And even deeper than that, they were the victims of terror that came by way of blowback because of Washington's crimes that they had done in the Islamic world, you know, for a long, long time. And this is not to justify. Here's my point that I'm making, Andrea. This is not to justify what was done on 9/11 in any shape, form, or fashion. But it is a reason behind it, 9/11, and could have been avoided. And so, yeah, exactly. So if somebody, you know, calls me a name, no. You know, if I go ahead and punch them in the face, it's not justified. I should have the restraint to say, I'm not going to punch you in the face, and I'm not going to resort to violence. But to the root of it, I mean, it could have been avoided if so and so did call me a name. And my point is that I'm making, Andrea, is that if it's unjustified for people to exact terror upon American citizens and, because of the crimes of Washington, and take it out on Washington, on American citizens for the crimes of their government that they've done all over the world, then, Andrea, the question I ask you, shouldn't it be unjustified for the U.S. to go and do mass airstrikes in November of 2001 in Afghanistan and summarily killing 3,000-plus Afghan civilians within a short period of time? Now, we know that the number is much larger right now in terms of civilians that have been killed in Afghanistan, but right then and there, we're talking about the same amount of number of Afghan civilians that were killed by U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan. But you know what, Andrea? Shouldn't it be unjustified for these people to catch hell based on the actions of other people that did not represent the people on the ground in Afghanistan? They didn't represent the people on the ground. I mean, for God's sakes, I mean, 15 of the 19 alleged, you know, bombers, they were Saudi nationals anyways. And so what do the people have to do? So that the people that got massacred, they had as little to do with 9/11 as did the people in the World Trade Centers had to do with Washington's decisions. Am I correct on that? Does it make sense?
Right, absolutely. And there's a good article that I read today on commondreams.org by Press Porter called "Terrorism Issue That Wasn't Discussed." And he talks just about how, people don't realize that invading all these countries and killing people's families, people who are innocent, like you were describing, is really creating a new cycle of terrorism, all the young people that have seen their families killed are going to be more moved and more interested in participating in the jihadist movement, right? And so, he has a link to a website that gives some numbers on the drone attacks in Pakistan and, the number of civilians killed so far, the total killed is 2,309. And the total strikes have been 295, and under Obama, it's 243. So, the majority of them have been under Obama, and so I just think that, that's interesting because most people don't want to paint this picture that, just believe whatever he says and his speeches and his slogans and whatnot. But nonetheless, I think that the really important point that he made in this article is that going into other countries and killing thousands of people, and like you were saying, the equivalent
tens of
multiple,
thousands.
Right, multiple 9/11s in their countries is not the way to, solve a terrorist issue. It's only creating it's only exacerbating the issue more because more people are going to be radicalized after seeing, 19 of their members murdered for absolutely no reason.
Right, and to this day, it's like tens of thousands of people, and this doesn't exclude Pakistan, where people they don't even show you this footage, but even on a daily basis, man, you have people that are in Pakistan that are going in front of the U.S. The monstrosity of an embassy, the U.S. embassy, and protesting daily, weekly. To, for America to stop what it's doing, to stop, bombing Pakistan. And so we see that going on north Waziristan region of Pakistan. Obviously, we see it throughout. The bombs are what we're talking about, the drone strikes, folks, but it's much bigger than that. It's much bigger than that. We're talking about the boots on the ground. We're talking about night raids that have dragged, as adolescent boys out of their homes, and have been, not just like interrogated, but many of them have been murdered and have been gunned down. I mean, we're talking about barbaric things. And so I think that if it's about mourning the victims of 9/11, we must mourn as well. If we're going to mourn the American victims, we have to or the victims that died, in Ground Zero, what's now known as Ground Zero. We also must mourn the victims in Iraq. You know, we're talking about anywhere between 700,000 to 800,000 to over 1 million. You know, the numbers are kind of fuzzy, but you know, even if we're looking at one of the most conservative estimates, 700,000, that's a hell of a lot of civilians, you know, killed in Iraq. You know, from Iraq to Afghanistan to Pakistan, these are all also 9/11 casualties. These are also casualties of 9/11, and the retaliation of 9/11. The U.S. is just like this damn. I mean, just it's like a crazed. I mean, just to call the U.S. a bully is kind of like a, I don't know. It's almost a very euphemistic way of putting things. The U.S. is more, you know, more akin to I would say a serial killer, a compulsive serial killer. Just you know, that doesn't know, it's pathological. I mean, it doesn't know where to stop. I mean, it just goes. I'm going to go and I'm going to kill here and here, and because this is my goal, and it's pathological, Andrea. But I'm glad you mentioned Obama, the jolly old mythological man. Obama's real, but the whole fact that this guy is some kind of hope and change for all those folks out there that voted for him. Some people caught their minds, but so a whole bunch didn't. This guy is this guy being some mythological progressive change agent or agent for social change is like jolly old Saint Nick. So I want to play this clip from Black Agenda Report on Obama, and we'll see you on the other side.
It has begun. Obama's 2012 presidential campaign saw union workers in Detroit, a large proportion of them black, spending their Labor Day chanting, "Four more years," after four of the worst years in African American history, from an economic standpoint. Barack Obama has been a prime shaper of events for the last three of those years, since October 2008, when he single-handedly saved George Bush's bank bailout after it had initially been defeated. Obama then assembled an economic team comprised of the same people that had set the stage for the meltdown less than a decade before. He spent the first year of his presidency making health care safe for the drug racketeers and private insurers through backroom deals that froze out members of Congress most friendly to blacks and labor, the Democratic Party's core constituencies. Within a year, the left wing of the Democratic Party was beaten down, demoralized, and isolated at the hands of the first black president. From then on, the parameters of the national political conversation were confined to a narrow spectrum that went from Obama, the corporate center-right Democrat, to the Tea Party, the corporate-financed white nationalists. Nothing favorable to blacks or labor could possibly emerge from such a toxic political mix. But it was a mix of Obama's making. This was Obama brew, and he was the bartender through 2 years when the Democrats, with a congressional majority, were encouraged by their president to behave as if the Republicans were in charge. In 2010, the Republicans did take charge in the House, and it was as if they had seized the entire government. There was no push for a national jobs program in Obama's first year, despite good chances for passage, because Obama did not want one. Labor's most sought-after legislation, the card check bill that might reverse the steady decline in union membership, got nowhere in the Democratic Congress, because Obama did not support it. Then, in the second year, he dropped even the pretense that jobs were a top priority and began shouting like a Republican banshee about deficits and the need for austerity. Blacks saw their futures flushed down the toilet while Obama dismissed them with nonsense about fictitious rising tides. Latinos, whose growing numbers are shaping America's future, watched while the Democrat that two-thirds of them voted for deported more immigrants than his Republican predecessor. Who has Obama not betrayed in the traditional Democratic base? The environmentalists got their education in Obamaism last week when the president made the executive decision to stick with George Bush's pollution standards, to great applause from big business. For those who were looking for a president who would stand up to Wall Street and the Pentagon, Obama has been a dismal failure. But for those on the right, whose mission in life is to utterly smash the power of blacks and unions, Obama has been a godsend. The Democratic base, to the extent that it votes, will vote for Obama in 2012, seeing him as the lesser of evils. But he is, in fact, the more effective evil, having done more damage to Democratic core constituencies than any Republican could dream of. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Yeah, that was right on time, right on time, right on time. Yeah, this dude continues to build his war chest, which is going to approach around $1 billion. I mean, we thought $746 million when he ran for election was a lot of money, which it was. $1 billion. I mean, and now we know, Andrea, with the Citizens United ruling, I mean, that, you know, these rapacious, capitalist, you know, scumbag Democrats and Republicans are going to continue to line their coffers with as much corporate-driven money as they possibly can, because as we know in America, the sweatshop of capitalism, you know, he or she who has the most money is usually the one that you know, is going to get you know, the best opportunity to win a particular election. But Andrea, Glenn mentioned something really interesting. I mean, you know, talking about Obama and the whole, you know, jobs deal and you know, we saw the you know, talk that he gave at Congress several days ago. And what's interesting, you heard that speech, which I did, you know, he mentions, I mean, without any uncertainty, you know, and this thing, it cannot be looked at as a New Deal kind of jobs creation program, because it's all going to come at cost, because, you know, he's still talking, Andrea, about cutting Medicaid. He's talking about cutting Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security, and we know that they have intentions of packaging Social Security as a to private corporations on Wall Street, because they're salivating at getting their hands on that Social Security money. So it's stuff that you know, hopefully, I don't know, man. This guy is one of the biggest frauds that I've seen in quite some time, and I'm just glad that there is perspective out there, like, you know, Brother Glenn Ford and Black Agenda Report. But, you know, folks really need to kind of wake up, because supporting this dude, especially, you know, folks within the black community, supporting this guy as if he's some kind of he doesn't give a damn about the black community, and he certainly doesn't give a damn about what we're going to be talking about this episode with Brother Benjamin Woods, who I think is on the line right now. I'm going to be putting on in a couple minutes when it comes to mass incarceration, when it comes to the institutionally racist, teeth that are locked into black communities from stolen coast to stolen coast. We have to, brothers like Benjamin Woods and community activists and students alike, and us ourselves have to make this is a national epidemic within the black and brown community, especially within the African community in the United States of America. It continues to destroy family and individuals and communities left and right. So before we put before I patch Benjamin through, I want to play this clip to kind of set the stage and then have Benjamin Woods come on. But this is just a very quick piece, a five-minute piece that was on RT Russia Today. And folks, those of you guys who are not familiar with Russia Today, yeah, you're going to hear an American voice, but this is not U.S. corporate media. This is not in any shape, form, or fashion. This kind of critical analysis you don't get on the capitalist media system in the U.S. So I'm going to play this, and then we're going to bring Benjamin Woods on the other side.
Private prison companies right here in the U.S. working to make money through harsh policies and longer sentences. Now, government spending on corrections has soared since 1997 by 72%. That is up $74 billion. And the private prison industry has raked in tremendous profits. Joining me now for more from our LA studio is Anna Kasparian of the Young Turks to talk about what's behind all of this. Thanks so much for being with her. It's nice with us. It's nice to see you. Now, in this report, the authors note that while the total number of people in prison has increased less than 16%, the number of people held in private, federal, and state facilities has increased by 120 and 33%, respectively. So what exactly is behind those numbers?
Well, what these private prisons are doing, for instance, there's the GEO Group or Corrections Corporation of America. What they're doing is they're lobbying to Congress to ask Congress to push stricter regulations or stricter laws. Like, for instance, the whole immigration law that was passed in Arizona, that was something that the private prisons in the United States were really pushing for, because they knew that if more immigrants are targeted, they can arrest those immigrants, put them in private prisons, and then these private prisons can make huge profits. Another thing that's happening is they're asking politicians to be very, very hard on drugs, okay? Make sure that we don't end this war on drugs, even though there was a global commission that showed that this war on drugs has been an absolute failure. Why are politicians ignoring that? They're ignoring that because they know that private prisons are fattening up their pockets and private prisons are making huge profits. And just to give you an idea of those profits, both Corrections Corporation of America and GEO Group made a total of $2.9 billion last year alone. So, you know, they're spending a considerable amount on lobbying. They spend about $835,000 on federal candidates and $6 million on state candidates. And you know what? That they definitely got some bang for their buck.
That is a lot of money. That is a lot of lobbying. We hear this with a lot of different industries that have that kind of lobbying power to spend. We hear that with Wall Street. We hear that with, you know, the pharmaceutical industry. I'm curious, you know, this is prisoners. These are people's lives. These are the policies that affect, you know, justice. So what do you see as being some of the consequences of this?
Oh, there are huge consequences, and I'll give you a perfect example of that. A couple months ago, a story broke about a Pennsylvania judge by the name of Mark Cavarella, and I highly encourage everyone to look him up. What this judge did is he got rid of all county detention centers for juveniles, okay? And then what he did is he made sure that only private detention centers for juveniles remained. Now, people didn't know this, but at the time, private detention centers were funding Mark Cavarella, you know, under the table. And what he would do is he would send high school students to these juvenile detention centers, for-profit private juvenile detention centers, for tiny, petty little offenses. I'll give you an example. One high school student got caught stealing nutmeg, and she spent 3 months in prison, or not in prison, 3 months in that juvenile detention center for that. Okay, so that's a huge consequence. We're not playing here. These are minors that are spending time in these for-profit centers because these judges are getting paid off. So he got caught, thankfully. He got prosecuted, and he is no longer a judge. He faced the consequences. But you got to keep in mind, whenever a prison system is privatized, what are they going to want to do? The number one thing they're going to want to do is profit. So they're going to lobby politicians so they pass laws and rules that will make it very easy for us to get locked up for tiny little offenses. We're hearing about stories throughout the country where states want to basically sentence people to prison for life if they get caught with hash. What is that about? So that, I think that there are major consequences for this.
It's about being tough on drugs, Anna. I'm just joking with you. No, it sounds, I mean, I was just in Ireland, and back in the 1500s in the prisons, they threw kids in there for stealing flowers. I mean, it doesn't sound very different from your nutmeg story, which we hear in modern day U.S. My question, though, for you, you know, you mentioned the money that private prisons are spending. These are privatized companies. Obviously, there's a lot of leeway for corporate power to spend money like this. So what do you see as the solution? Is the problem that they're privatized? Is the problem better regulations of campaign donations and lobbying? I mean, what do you really see as the solution to this, especially now that it's getting some more attention and there's more examples?
The root of every single problem in the United States right now is the fact that corporations are able to fund politicians as much as they want. Citizens United was a huge problem, okay? The fact that our Supreme Court passed Citizens United was disastrous for this country, okay? There needs to be regulation. We need to have campaign finance reform. There needs to be a political revolution. And, you know, and I'm not saying a violent political revolution. I'm saying that we need to make sure that there are limits to the amount of money that people can donate to campaigns. And when it comes to corporations, it's never ending. They get what they want because they have the money. Private prisons are getting what they want because they have the money. And pretty soon, we're going to be spending some time in prison for minor offenses. So there needs to be a revolution when it comes to situations like this.
All right, there you have it. Anna Kasparian calling for a revolution of the Young Turks. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, that was RT, and I'm going to bring on Benjamin Woods right now. And as I said before, Benjamin Woods is a PhD candidate at Howard University. He's the co-founder of SAMI, which is Students Against Mass Incarceration, and they also have SAMI TV, where, you know, we've even posted some of the videos from SAMI TV on yourworldnews.org, where they take the cameras out to the community and they talk to people, to black folks, to Africans in Washington, D.C., who are being affected by, you know, just the police state that has been imposed upon, you know, African communities, you know, throughout Washington, D.C. And obviously we know that D.C. is just a microcosm of what it is seen through most African communities throughout the U.S., whether it's Detroit, you know, Baltimore, you know, South Central L.A. I mean, we can go on and on. Houston, Texas, Miami. I mean, I can just keep going on and on. And so, you know, Benjamin Woods and his comrades, they've done a tremendous work. And as I said, last week they had this forum called The New Jim Crow, where they were, you know, used the backdrop of Michelle Alexander's book and had a town hall forum. And you know what I love about it is that this is what it's about. In order for us to really get the word out and to educate, you know, our communities, this is what needs to be done. These kind of community forums that are free, that are in the community, and we have to do as many of them as we possibly can, you know, to mobilize and protect ourselves, to protect our families, our communities, because this prison industrial complex and mass incarceration is a killer. It is a killer and a destroyer. So I want to welcome Benjamin Woods on to Your World News. Benjamin, are you on?
I am here. Good evening, brother. Good to hear from you. That was a powerful piece you just played from Russia today. They always do the hard-hitting news, like you said.
Yeah, you're right. And you're not going to hear that. You're not going to see that on MSNBC.
You are not going to see it on CNN. You're not even probably going to get it on Democracy Now! Probably. Let's keep it real. You know,
no,
a lot of
definitely
stuff,
not.
So, I mean, a lot of that the news, and that's part of the reason we started the SAMI TV, is to really get our own voice out there, you know, very much so.
Right on. I want to hit the ground running. I want to ask you, start by asking you, if you can get into the derivation of SAMI, why, you know, who are the folks that came together with yourself to create it? You know, may seem like a silly question, but why did you, you know, decide to create such an organization, and how did it start?
Well, it really came out of, there's a particular professor at Howard University named Dr. Kito Swan. He actually has a book just came out called Black Power in Bermuda, and he actually teaches courses at Howard on Black Power, the Black Power movement. And very powerful brother, and really comes out of that and very much is active, very much respect him. And he was, and within his courses when he was teaching, he would actually have students write a political prison as part of the course. He would have people in like the graduate level courses even read books like The New Jim Crow, The Land, The War Before by Sophia Bakar, a member of the Black Liberation Army and the Black Panther Party in class. And it really spurred the students, and that's how you know you're getting real education. It spurred the students to really, we have to do something. We can't just read this material and just not do anything and just be scholars here on top of the hill and be at the Mecca. So they said, no, let's start an organization. I wasn't in those classes. I had done some previous work around political prisoners, prison industrial complex. They knew me. And we started the organization. And that was earlier this year in the spring, and we've been, like you said, engaged in various different community activities, and that was really the spur of it. And that really, I think, shows the power of that brother's pedagogy right there.
Right, definitely. How did the, just a follow up question? How did the forum go last week? How did that go? How
the
was the attendance?
The forum went
actually went
very well. Those community discussions are something that does not happen enough in the community. I mean, I think when you read Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, is she kind of talks about that. As in our community, sometimes where people are ashamed of, you know, their history or past, or especially family members, we don't want to talk about it, even though most black people, well, actually all of us have friends, family members that are incarcerated in this country, because it is, you know, it's just so pervasive and so massive, the incarceration that's happening. So really to have those sort of discussions on a regular basis, this one was on campus. The next one will be actually near Howard at a local recreation center, and we'll be discussing similar issues around gentrification and mass incarceration. But the actual this new Jim Crow forum had a really good turnout. Good discussion from the community. We had a panel, but really of myself and two other brothers who had been formerly incarcerated themselves. One was incarcerated with Marshall Eddie Conway and was politicized through him, and another brother who was incarcerated as well on drug charges. And we really, and the main part of it was really a good community discussion. And really what came out of that, we got a lot of good ideas. We did video record it, took notes as well, because we didn't just want to have a forum, and then, well, we all got together, had a good discussion, had a panel, and we all go home. And we feel better at the end of the day for the day, and we have to go back to the real world of racism, white supremacy, and capitalism. So to really engage in some action, some people, the case of Troy Anthony Davis is something that was really brought up during the time is that Troy Anthony Davis, who's a black man in Georgia, Savannah, Georgia, was convicted of murdering a white police officer in 1989, and he actually had his execution date was set for him his 4th on September 21st, and as 9 witnesses said, they saw him shoot a police officer. 7 have recanted their testimony. There's no physical evidence connecting the man to the crime. And so this weekend we knew that Howard and Morehouse were going to be playing, and said, well, you know, wait a minute, there's people from Georgia. All these people from Georgia are going to be up here. Let's go to the game, talk to people, pass out flyers, see what, you know, try to get people to call into the governors and border paroles, because as many people, the more support they see if people aren't against it, they can end the case. So we went there and did that, and now that was Thursday, the event. Saturday we were there. This Friday we will do something for the International Day of Action on campus. So that's just to really keep it moving and have these regular forums and really get into the community, like you're saying, is really the principal thing. We don't want to just have events, you know, just having an event, and that's what some of the movement has been stalled, and it's become a series of programs and events and panel discussions and conferences. And to really get past that and really push it, have another generation push it to a lower, to a higher level.
Right. Andrea.
Brother Benjamin, I just wanted to ask you, since you mentioned in the beginning a little bit of the historical context in terms of the prison industrial complex in the black community, can you talk a little bit about the slave patrols and, you know, how they started in the 1700s, their function, and how they can relate to, you know, the police department and the police brutality that we see in the black community today?
All the slave patrols, definitely. And for us as well, I think it's important to even really have a very important point when we talk about the prison industrial complex, and that is to start with, especially with the 13th Amendment as well. And many people that allegedly this amendment abolished slavery, right, allegedly. But when you actually read the fine print, it says involuntary servitude is abolished except in cases of punishment for a crime. So slavery is still legal within the United States in reality. And if you've been convicted of a so-called crime, and so the state can own human beings. And that's where really the prison industrial complex is allowed, when you have Corrections Corporations of America and Wackenhut, as the previous that video clip you showed. But I think many people have done a lot of work in showing where many of the whites, especially, I'm not as familiar with it, but I do know the basic overview, that many of the whites, the state patrols, the people who were enslaved, you actually recruited whites, because you have to remember, the majority of white people did not actually own Africans. The majority, it was actually a smaller crew of people who during the enslavement period that actually owned, so they would recruit white people to actually go on patrols and watch, you know, as these slave catchers, watch people on the street, make sure the Africans and black people are not running away and be fugitives. And that's sort of the origins of the modern police force as we see it and know it. And sometimes even with labor unions in the North, there's a connection there between the beginning of police in the North. In the South, it's more the patrols of people going, you know, watching there. So that historical context of just even particularly with the 13th Amendment allowing, you know, the idea that you can make money off of prisons is still there, right there in that 13th Amendment. And that's something we have to study. And many people have even talked about it, redoing of the constitutional amendment of some kind to really overcome that.
And I just wanted to follow up by asking you, can you just give us some of the numbers in terms of how many black men are incarcerated in the U.S. now versus, you know, like in during Jim Crow and in comparison to men of other racial backgrounds today?
Well, today, I mean, if you look at when Martin Luther King was assassinated, there were not even 100,000 black men in prison, somewhere around that number, but between then and especially since 1980, you had an explosion of particularly black men that were incarcerated. Today, it's well over almost a million black men are imprisoned. But we actually need to talk also, I think more discussion needs to be had around black women in the prison system, because that's one of the fastest growing areas of where you see people incarcerated is black women. That's one of the fastest growing populations. It's exploding there now as well. But in terms of like it's a little over a million now, it exploded, especially between 1980 and today because of particularly the drug law. The 1986 anti and 1988 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, particularly establishing mandatory minimum sentences, telling judges you cannot set a prison sentence any lower than this set statute, or as well as the crack, so the disparities between crack and powder cocaine that were recently lowered, but they were, quote unquote, 100-1. So if you have 500 grams of powder cocaine, you get the same sentence as someone who has 5 grams of crack cocaine. Now, the only difference is powder cocaine is more used by whites, the crack form is used more by blacks. But that actually recently was changed from 18-1 by this president here. You have, but that's 18-1, but that still is not, it's still not even equal. It's 18-1. So that's still that's still an amazing number in of itself. People could say, you know, that may be a campaign, you know, during 2012, we'll hear that during the campaign when he speaks to black audiences, which will probably be a rarity because he's race neutral, right? So when he does that, it'll be it's kind of, I lowered it, but it's still 18-1. Right, okay. So that disparity is still there, and it's going to continue to feed. And I think that clip you gave a great analysis of the situation. And I think, too, one thing that we like to bring out in our organization in terms of, like, with the drug laws particularly, it's drugs, is ask the question, how does cocaine and heroin getting into this country? Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of research, a whole set of literature, not some conspiracy theory stuff. I mean, people at universities, academic professors, have talked about this. You can read the biggest known case, best research, is probably the most well-known is Gary Webb and Dark Alliance, right? Yes. He's done the research to show where the United States, 1980s, there was a revolution, a socialist revolution occurred in Nicaragua, and in order to help, the United States government funded, set up an organization called the Contras and funded them. And how they funded them was to helping them get cocaine and selling cocaine to drug dealers in South Central Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And so the United States government has been consistently complicit in this situation of the international drug trade in order to fund their CIA covert operations in various parts of the world. And so that's the fundamental. So you look at the whole thing is stacked. You see, you're helping to bring drugs into the country. You set up drug laws. You set up a whole prison for profit industry. And at the same time, and now we're seeing in the last few years, you see Bill Cosby going on his whirlwind tours throughout the ghettos of North America, telling black people how they need to work harder and do this and do that. When in reality, mm-hmm. there is literally a system set up so you will fail. Right. And you sort of, so they come this, you know, just work harder, or you made the wrong choices. And then you got to get into the fact of, well,
wait a minute, where the jobs? What about jobs? Well, black people were in the southern part of the United States in rural areas, and they came to the urban areas because many of them saw jobs, manufacturing, industrial jobs. But those are, to a large extent, gone now. Those industrial manufacturing jobs that many, particularly black men, had have gone. They've gone to China, India, Mexico, other parts of the world, or they've been automized. And so there is a whole system, a capitalist system, that is working here. And it's not just as simple as this rhetoric that we've been hearing over the past 30 years. Someone my age, anyone my age and younger, our whole life we've been hearing this rhetoric about, oh, the women in the ghetto, and they're spending welfare money and driving in Cadillacs. The black men are lazy and this and that. But there literally is, and not just a conspiracy theory stuff. You can document, and social science research has documented all of these things I'm saying.
Right, right. And thank you for that broad description, and because that was leading towards a question I wanted to ask you is, you know, and you touched on that, you know, with the whole connection between capitalism. I was wondering if you could really kind of give us some examples of how capitalism, you know, the triplets of capitalism, you know, white supremacy, institutional racism, how these intersectionalities, you know, come together and kind of play an important role, not a good role, but an important role.
Sustaining the
system.
Well, I mean, just some of the things I went through. When you look at it, fundamentally, the issue is capitalism. I mean, that's the fundamental problem we're having to deal with here. That's the prison industrial complex. What is capitalism is about? It's about maximizing as much profit as humanly possible. I mean, just accumulating as much profit and capital as you can. And when you look at the prison system, and you look at what the information that you gave out from that Russia Today clip. You have Corrections Corporations of America and Wackenhut making tens of millions of dollars every year, right? And then you have the situation where places like everything from American Express to Victoria's Secret, you know, is making using products. So you call someone, you know, sometimes American Express, you may be talking to someone who's incarcerated. You may have someone, the Victoria's Secret you're wearing, that your sister is wearing, a prisoner may have made, someone incarcerated may have made that. You have all these furniture, cell phones, so much of it is made, and you can pay people. There are no unions in prison, you know. They don't really have, you know, not really unions. There's no union, you have to worry about that. You don't have to have that situation in Wisconsin, people fighting like that. No, they're not going to be allowed to do that and organize in that way. You're talking about a complete system of total domination of a human being and violating their humanity. So when you talk about prisons, that's what you're talking about. They're not going to be organizing any unions anytime soon. So all of that is directly connected to capitalism. When you look at the issue of I talked about the industry and the jobs leaving. Well, that's a part of what they call so-called corporate globalization, very nice kind of term, but really that's just global capitalism, right? And those jobs being shipped off to other places, what, because it's cheaper, right? You can pay someone in China or India 10 times less than you can pay someone, a worker in the United States, and a brother or sister that's in Chicago or Philadelphia or New York or Baltimore, obviously. So all of this is directly connected to capitalism and white supremacy, and as it affects black people in the form of white supremacy, right? And you see the over-policing right. that goes on in various communities. Here, something we've learned by doing those videos, going into the community, talking to people, they have in D.C., they have a name for them called jump outs, right? So they'll see a brother, a sister, or even an elder, we found out. We expected, you know, probably the most of it is the attacks is going to be geared more towards black men. But, no, really going out there, it's really something to see who is everybody's under attack. If you're black, you're under attack. And to see where you have these SWAT, like Michelle Alexander talks about SWAT teams in her book and them getting money because of how much, who they arrest and being able to keep the, you know, if they arrest someone just on an arrest charge or they will take everything out of your home, take all of your possessions, and it's less of a burden of proof, more of a burden of proof for you to prove, right, to get your things back. So all of this, is you're seeing economics and various things, it's a very similar, the economic system of capitalism at the very root of it.
And that's what we really have to build a movement for. I mean, and what I like about, you know, organizing around the prison issue is you have to talk about class. You definitely have to, talk about race and class and how all these things, like you said, intersection, and how they're working together, right? Because even if you look at the labor issue, if you're paying someone 25, 35 cents an hour that's incarcerated, this person, that undercuts the wages of people, those of us who are outside, who are working and trying right now, trying to find a job, I suppose, you know. So all of this plays in.
Right. Andrea?
I wanted to ask you if you could tell us a little bit about the conditions in prisons and why we, you know, recently we've seen a lot of hunger strikes in places like Georgia and even in Pelican Bay.
Well, yeah, I mean, once again, I mean, you're talking about an institution designed to really strip someone. You have to strip someone of their humanity, an attempt anyway. You can't actually do it, but attempt to strip someone of their humanity, their personhood. So, I mean, the degrading conditions, you have situations where people are, you know, attempt to, it's very difficult to organize, but when you first come in, people are told, you know, you're being told when to eat, where to eat. I just really read a very good piece by Marshall Eddie Conway, who wrote Martial Law, and he talks about when he first gets into a prison, one prison, you have a certain amount of time. He sat down and he wondered, why is there no one's talking? They're just eating very fast as they can, not looking up, just going. And someone blew a whistle and everyone got up and put their food away, and he was still just sitting there taking his time eating. So even you, when you eat, I mean, how you, your eating time, you have a situation where guards are sometimes having prison fights in prison, right? Paying people, you know, have prisoners fight and they'll bet on it, these kind of things. Having someone, in order to keep control, having certain prisoners, rape is rampant, and that's used as a tool even by sometimes the prison guards or the prison warden and the prison itself. I mean, it's one of the most degrading conditions that you're going to find and that you're going to find in these prisons. And if you try to speak up or organize around it, they'll lock you up. You know, you're locked up, you know, in a 23-hour, 24-hour hold. You know, really good, you know, discussion. I like Marshall Eddie Conway's book of The Last Man Standing by Geronimo Pratt. And they have a very good, you know, political lens and personal experience on that, of what it's like to be in those holes and what it is really like. You know, if you just try to, you know, help some people learn a few things and politicize them, who knows what can happen to you. And you're a target as soon as you get in there, especially if you someone who's political or become political once inside.
Right. Benjamin, I'm glad you mentioned Marshall Eddie Conway. Could you talk to us? I know you've done a lot of work around political prisoners as well. Can you tell our listeners about the issue of black political prisoners that are languishing in America's prisons today, and what what their crime was incarcerated?
Right. Very important. Well, this country has a history of repression, a strong history of political repression when people attempt to organize, when the masses of people, when working black people, First Nations, so-called Indians, Chicano people, white left labor organizers, white labor organizers attempt to organize. It has a long history of repression in this country. So when you look at, for instance, you can look at the 1960s, you had something called the Counterintelligence Program under the auspice of the FBI, which was actually started in 1956 to watch the Communist Party. But as time went into the 60s, it was focused more on the black liberation movement, American Indian movement, Chicanos, various, you know, white left, the anti-war movement. And through this program, it was designed, and this is a quotation from J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, to disrupt, discredit, and otherwise neutralize black nationalist hate-type organizations. Okay, so there was illegal surveillance. There were assassinations, the most known case, but there were much more than this one. Is Fred Hampton in Chicago, murdered on December 4th, 1969, in his bed with police, because the FBI worked with local police. Really, the local police did the dirty work, but they worked with the local police to assassinate people. Fred Hampton was a 21-year-old, one of the most gifted, skilled orators and organizers in this country, was actually just put on the Central Committee of the Black Panther Party, and was murdered in his bed as he was asleep with his girlfriend, who was 8 months pregnant next to him. along with Mark Clark. He was drugged by an informant, a snitch in the organization to keep him asleep when they were about to assassinate him. You have people that are in exile outside of this country, and you still have people that are in prison, like Marshall Eddie Conway, who's been in prison since 1970, Jaleel Muntakim since 1971. Jaleel Muntakim went in as a 19-year-old about to become a father, expecting father, and now he's a grandfather. Robert Seth Hayes, Sundi Ata Akoli, the names and list of them go on and on. Even Andrew Young, who lost his job, right, as a UN ambassador in 1979, someone asked him a question, are there political prisoners in the United States? He said, yes, of course, probably hundreds. And, of course, he lost his job behind that, right? So this is a case where people around the world know, especially the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal is probably the most well-known, but there are so many others in this country of various movements, Black Liberation Movement, principally people who are in the Black Panther Party, the Black Liberation Army, and the Republic of New Africa, in terms of the Black Liberation Movement, who are in prison and are still fighting. And I think it's important that we, an important point of a memo, because you can do a Freedom of Information Act. You can look at people like Ward Churchill, who's done a lot of research, some of the best research, I think, possibly on this. And actually, Marshall Eddie Conway, who is in prison, has a book now called The Greatest Threat. He goes through the history of repression in this country, particularly on the Panther Party and the Black Liberation Movement. But it goes through the entire history of the United States government repression. Very good text. But this history of just repression and these people who are still incarcerated, but the point being, one point that was made in one of these memos, I believe it was 1967, August 25th, when J. Edgar Hoover said, one of the points we want to make sure is that young people know that if you want to be a black revolutionary, you'll be a dead revolutionary. And that was for the young people, to make sure that another generation didn't attempt to organize in the same way. And when you look at the prison industrial complex, yes, we can talk about the massive amounts of, you know, money is being made, but you have to also look at it as a form of social control to stop, because that's who's being in prison. Is it's our peers that aren't in college, right, who are not the working class, black folk, poor, who are being imprisoned, who if they were outside, they would be, most likely, if they were not in car, they would be organizing. They would be a major problem for the system. So they have to be over-policed. They have to be incarcerated in warehouses in these concentration camps we call prison. They have to be there.
Right.
Yeah. In the beginning of the show, we were talking, about some of the issues surrounding post 9/11 in terms of the military industrial complex. But I just wanted to ask you, in terms of the prison industrial complex, have you seen, an increase in the mass incarceration of other communities, including Latinos, Arabs, Sikhs, and Muslims, and people just from Southeast Asia?
Well, definitely. I think even in that clip they discussed that, because one of the areas I think where possibly that the corporations, Corrections Corporations of America, which by the way has a prison located in Southeast D.C., right? They see the fact that especially with this so-called illegal immigration, right? Someone who stole a country. This is a white settler state. Sometimes we don't mention that enough. I think in our movement we need to say that more. This white settler state is telling people who are coming, particularly Latinos, but many other people, as you mentioned, is using that as private detention because there's money to be made. There's so much that's whipping up this anti-immigrant kind of thing going on against particularly Latino people, you know, to really ramp up that, and because there's a whole industry and continue to make money in that area. You know, there's cases in Arizona where those Corrections Corporations of America specifically is lobbying certain Congress people to change the laws and really get a certain laws passed, you know. So especially in the area of so-called this anti-immigrant push, you have to make that connection between the prison industrial complex and these detention centers and the ICE and the ICE immigration. What is it? I can't remember the exact acronym, but ICE is these various things that are just that way immigrant, the anti-immigrant push. And the prison industrial complex are very much connected.
Very, very much so. Yeah, Benjamin, what can people listen to right now? Because I mean, you
painted a beautiful picture in terms of explaining a range of things connected to the PIC and mass incarceration. Folks that are listening right now, what can we do? What are some of the things that we can do on a mass scale to reverse the trends of the prison industrial complex and mass incarceration? What can we do as especially like us as Black folks?
I think one of the things is we really have to stop being. Michelle Alexander discusses this. Stop being scared of poor working class Black folks. I think a lot of people are almost scared to really even be around. You know, there's a certain fear that we think we associate with whites, but also Black people have as well. To really have to go into these communities where our people are, and really have these forums and discussions, and really begin to go and talk to people. I mean, when we go places and we talk, we've been in everywhere from the Trinidad neighborhood to LaDroit Park to various areas. And when we talk to young brothers and sisters or elders, when we tell them what we're doing, they are so happy and proud. Some people just say, thank you. Thank you.
Right.
You know, just to really begin that process of, you have to look at who's really going to make this change. I think it's going to be the people who are most affected. You know, there's plenty of brothers and sisters, plenty of George Jackson that are incarcerated right now. I would put a plug for it. Yeah, a book called Defying the Tomb, a brother named Kevin Rashid Johnson, who's locked up, I believe it's in Richmond, who has really put out a new book, and it's a young brother. He's like 40 years old, so he comes out of not the Black Power Movement generation. And to read that text, it's very much put in a mold of a George Jackson, very much on a revolutionary theoretical tip. But I think just looking to the people who are actually going to make the change, having regular discussions and forums, because we're not talking about this issue enough, going into the community and having it, and just really seeing who is going to make the change. And I think it's going to be people who are most impacted by this issue, I think.
Right. I wanted to thank you. But before we let you go, how can folks, number one, get in contact with you? And then, secondly, how can they, you know, access Sammy TV? And also, I love your blog, you know, Free the Land. If you could give all that kind of information out there, we'll also hyperlink it to our site as well.
Okay, so we have a YouTube channel called Howard Sammy, Howard, and then Sami. That's our YouTube channel. We put up videos regularly. When we go to various parts, we try to go to working class, poor Black communities, and just talk to people, push some of the things we're doing, and tell them what we're doing, who we are, and if we can, we actually do a short interview with them and tell us, you know, what's going on in your community, what is your relationship with the community, with the police, what are your personal experiences, what do you think this gentrification, and everyone is very clear on gentrification about what's going on in the city, how people are being dispossessed, the sort of, I almost liken it an analogy between the Israeli-Palestinian conflict going on, you know, just this white settlers coming in and dispossessing people of their land that's going on in D.C. and all over this country, right? But Howard Sammy is one of the first ones you can look at. My blog is called www.free-the-land.blogspot.com. I regularly update that at least probably couple times a month or two, almost every week if I can. You can contact us there. Our email is a little long, but we may have to change it soon. But it's STDNTS against mass incarceration. So it's students without any vowels. STDNTS against mass incarceration @gmail.com. So that's our information, and really get in contact with us. We really want to connect. We try to connect with as many community organizations, different kinds as possible. We're going to be organizing around this Troy Davis issue and really doing, we'd love to come into community. One of the main things we really want to do and have done is come into local, whether it's religious institutions, community centers, schools, and really talk to people about some of the information, everything from political prisoners or new workshops. We've done them on political prisoners, the prison industrial complex, Know Your Rights, all these various things. So please contact us about that. We'd love to come anywhere, you know, especially in the D.C., Baltimore area, and do, you know, workshops around those issues and really talk to people and tell them what we're doing and what you can do and how you can, you know, if you're at a college campus, especially at HBCU, a Black school, We would love to help people set up FAMI chapters on your campus. We already have a couple people that are very interested in that right now. So contact us and really get on this work. It's time for a new generation to step up.
All right. Thank you so much. And I plan on connecting with you offline because we have a program out here that, you know, where we've been going on a weekly basis to the Juvenile Detention Center in Maryland that houses all the, you know, the folks and, you know, predominantly, you know, young brothers who are, you know, from Washington, D.C., and they're mostly from Ward 7 and Ward 8. And so we do a weekly program. I'd love to bring you into the fold and try to, you know, see how we can collaborate and build upon that and get some more young folks that are not just inside but outside involved.
That really sounds great. We actually once a week go inside of Jessup Correctional Facility. Brother Marshall Eddie Conway has a program called Friend of a Friend, and we work with them inside and actually get to meet. He's there every week. We get to talk to him. I mean, that's amazing in of itself.
Wow.
So, I mean, but going there with him, so, I mean, that's something we need to collaborate, and maybe you all can come there. But we'll talk about that, exactly how we can collaborate. But definitely we want to connect as many Black college students, especially on these campuses, and really get to organizing around this issue and connect it to the other issues as we all have done earlier, and really be able to make the connections and bring it all together.
Right. Definitely. So thanks so much, and I look forward to talking to you, and you're welcome on Your World News any day of the week, and we will get your links to your sites, hyperlink to our yourworldnews.org. Thank you for spending the time with us.
Yeah, and thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It was very good. Anytime, I'll be glad to come back.
All right. Take care, brother.
All right. Take care. Peace.
Peace. Yeah, Andrea, that was that was great. Let's you know, play a clip from some of my comrades, Pace here, you know, and you know, let them take it from here, and we're gonna have a brief musical interlude. You know, this is a tune by Pay and Bashir Malouf called "Real Criminals." And on the other end, we'll be back and we'll discuss this that powerful interview that we had with Benjamin Woods of Students Against Mass Incarceration.
2006. We all faced with the same bullshit. Black cop, white cop, it don't matter. Bad cop. A cop killer, sick be murdered, they say wrongful death. When I kill, I'm an animal with no morals left. If a cop kills me, the loss is minimal. Police is hiding behind the law because they the real criminal. When a cop kills, sick be murdered, they say wrongful death. When I kill, I'm an animal with no morals left. If a cop kills me, the loss is minimal. Police is hiding behind the law because they the real criminal.
Yeah. The gang in blue steal the pigs, true. Now they got tear gas and billy clubs too. And if he clubs you, don't run from the challenge. Just cock back your hammers and put one in the cabin. The average policeman lacks proper respect, so I get respect back with the Glock of the tech. Before they had me on the deck, so blocking my neck. He'll catch this right hook and get dropped with the left. Who'd expect my enemy to look like me? Black cops showing off, he's just a crook like me. It's like we ignorant to our rights, we all seen. We should've left. What's that heat for New Orleans and then left. What's the foe for the Gulf Coast? They left people there with no hope, cause we poke folks. Most cops murder us and get slapped on the wrist. Uncle Tom MC scared to rap about this.
A cop killed, sick be murdered, they say wrongful death. When I kill, I'm an animal with no morals left. If a cop kills me, the loss is minimal. Police is hiding behind the law, cause they're real.
We're in the middle of a war, bars on your windows and doors. Your home is a prison, the way we live in is poor. The Lord got gas, act like we can't hold heat. That's the reason I speak, my folks can't stay sweet. Patrol our own streets, we're living in a police state. Y'all live behind steel gates to try to feel safe. Still race wars erupt, all my brothers are stuck. Behind prison bars, even scars, your third eye shut. Wise up, you gotta make the revenue stack. Before physical combat, your minds are attacked. So I got stacks of books, getting my mind chiseled. Trying to stay wise, exercise my mental. It's simple mathematics, my music is graphic. So this is what you get when the beast attacking. Get at us if you're ready to ride. This is what here's for, all my soldiers down. I'm never gonna hide.
A cop killed, sick be murdered, they say wrongful death. When I kill, I'm an animal with no morals left. If a cop kills me, the loss is minimal. Police is hiding behind the law because they the real criminals. A cop killed, sick be murdered, they say wrongful death. When I kill, I'm an animal with no morals left. If a cop kills me, the loss is minimal. Police is hiding behind the law because they the real criminals.
get away with murder. Every day, never pay for the people they heard of. Word up, the Patriot Act, that's the right back. Now pigs come in the crib and don't have to ask. Or even flash a warrant, they at war with my folks. Killing people cause they broke all over the Gulf Coast. Most folks obey the law, really might get stopped. And it's a 50-50 chance that you might get shot. And we not shocked to hear about cops getting shot, cause we know how they do when they come on the block, making it hot. And when money stops, it's critical police hide behind the law, cause they the real criminals.
A cop killing 60 murder that they want to death. When I kill, I'm an animal with no morals left. If a cop kills me, the law is criminal. Police hide behind the law, cause they the real criminals. A cop kills, they murder, they wrong to death. When I kill, all my animals with no morals left. If a cop kills me, the law is criminal. Police lie behind the law, cause they the real criminals.
Yeah, that was Payshare. Real criminals. Real criminals, baby. Yeah. Yeah, those comrades of mine, man. Man, just putting it down. So, you know, as we reflect, you know, on this interview that we just had with Brother Benjamin Woods of SAMHSA Students Against Mass Incarceration, I mean, he brought up a lot of points and a lot of critical analysis that, you know, is not found anywhere, you know, as we jumped off. You know, the interview, you know, pointing out that the U.S. corporate media is not gonna provide any critical analysis of the prison industrial complex and mass incarceration, new Jim Crow, you know, slavery, you know, modern day slavery, if you will, slavery by another name. You know, the literature is out there, folks. The literature is out there, you know, that really paints a broad picture of this is. Not some conspiracy theory. It is not a theory. It is real, and it is alive and prospering in the United States of America. And it's prospering means, you know, the destruction of the lives of countless Black people, and especially, you know, as you pointed out, I mean, the fastest growing prison population is Black women, and we know what it's doing to Black men, young Black men, to older Black men, political prisoners, left and right. And it simply has got to be something that we really, you know, make a concerted effort to get involved. So I hope folks that were listening to Benjamin will take the effort to contact that brother, email that brother, you know. Email him, check out his site, and email him. Find out how you can get involved, because I don't even care where you are, whether you're, you know, in Seattle, Washington, or someplace in between. It's really important that we understand the severity and also the importance of solidarity and coalition building around this issue. And every time that we, you know, sustain victories in these different battles of social issues that we see going on. I mean, you know, from this to imperialist wars, I mean, it sets the precedent for another victory to follow. It really does. And we have to see it on those kind of terms, but we got to be ready to do the work and to make some sacrifices with our time. Andre, what did you think about the interview and how it went?
You know, I thought it was incredible. In the context that he gave, I think it's always so important. You know, when you're talking about how, in a lot of cases, the youth doesn't really know, you know, how to approach the situation, because it's the way it's showed in the mainstream media. It's as if, you know, people who go to prison deserve to be in prison, and whatever treatment that they are given in prison is you know, well deserved. And so I think that being able to give young people a proper historical context of how this has affected the Black community and, you know, the inequalities and the laws and how they, you know, affect different groups of people, I think it's so critical to really starting to develop an understanding of how this is rooted in institutional racism, how it's an extension of slavery, and why it should be taken that seriously.
Right, and I want to play something. You, Andre, you brought something. You just actually triggered something in my mind. I want to, you know, I think our engineer found us a clip. This is Angela. This is a talk that Angela Davis did, and folks, Angela Davis has been doing work around this this issue for a long, long time. You know, yes, the Angela Davis, long time, you know, Black Panther. And she's been doing a ton of work with incarcerated folks and around the prison industrial complex and mass incarceration. I believe her last book, you know, focused on the role of the prosecutor. But I want to play this clip from Angela Davis, and I think she brings up a lot of salient and relevant points in the context of prison industrial complex and some of the things that Benjamin mentioned during the interview.
One of the reasons why the prison industrial complex has expanded as it has is because we have learned how to forget about prisons, even if they are in our own neighborhoods, even if we have relatives and friends in prison. And if you look in communities of color, almost everybody knows someone who is there or has been there, but we don't know how to talk about it. We don't integrate ideas about what is going on in these places in our daily conversation. We don't teach about the prison system. It's almost as if what this society does, first of all, is gets rid of the people who have the problems, people who have drug problems, you know, rather than recognizing that they are hurting themselves and they need some help. They need someone to help them. Rather than recognizing that, they just send them to prison. And the majority of women who are in prison are in there in relation to drug-related charges, right? And non-violent drug-related charges. So the idea is just send them to prison. Throw them away. Get rid of them. And if you get rid of them, then we don't have to think about them. And if we don't have to think about them, then we don't have to think about the problems that they have. So we don't really have to address the issue of drugs, which would require us also to talk about pharmaceutical companies. So I guess what I want to suggest that we all do is figure out ways of making these issues visible. And for people who have relatives or friends in prison, don't be ashamed of it. Because of the way the criminal is constructed, represented, many of us are even afraid to admit that we know someone who could be that kind of a person. But prisoners are like you and me. I mean, yeah, there's some pretty bad people in prison, but there's some pretty bad people who are not in prison. Over one third of all young Black men in this country in prison. Now, something is wrong with that. Don't you think? What I want to suggest is that there is a reason why increasing numbers of people of color, and women as well, because ever larger numbers of women are going to prison. There's a lot of real crime, and not only the people who are represented as criminals are the ones responsible for that crime. I mean, we can talk about corporate crime as well. I mean, we can talk about crimes against the environment that will affect generations to come. But of course, these people generally only pay fines if they do that, right? You know, how do we create contact between the inside and the outside? Between prison and what prisoners call the free world. Prisoners see us as living in the free world. I don't know how free this world is, because it certainly isn't free for a lot of people who are out here. But at least we can take advantage of the fact that we have the ability to move around in ways that people who are inside don't. As a matter of fact, we can sort of think about the relationship as being the relationship between slaves and abolitionists. Now, because as a matter of fact, the prison system contains obvious vestiges of slavery. Right? The 13th Amendment abolished slavery for all except those who are being punished for committing a crime. So in a lot of ways, what we see in the penitentiary system in this country is the continuation of the system of slavery. And that is why many of us suggest that what we need during this period is a late 20th century abolitionist movement, as there was a 19th century abolitionist movement. The question is creating some new institutions that really will speak to the problems that people have who go to prison, you know, rather than this prison system which continues to reproduce the problems, you know, for which people are sent to prison. One set of institutions consists of educational institutions. It costs much more to send someone to prison than it does to college or university. And many of those people who are now in prison would do well in an institution like this, would do better than a lot of the existing students. Think about prisoners as human beings who have a right to participate in the efforts that perhaps will lead to change. So I want to suggest the possibility of classes. I used to teach a class on incarcerated women at San Francisco State University, and I took a number of the students from San Francisco State into the San Francisco County Jail because I taught a class at the San Francisco County Jail as well. And one would think that, okay, you know, perhaps the students should teach the prisoners, but I decided to reverse it. I decided that the first phase would be for the students to learn from the prisoners. So the prisoners were positioned as the teachers, and they taught the students about that institution, what went on there, what the problems were.
Yeah, so Andre, I want to ask you a question, regarding what Angela Davis was just speaking about. And what are some of the things that she said regarding the prison system in America jumped out at you?
Yeah. I just think it's incredibly essential to put this in a larger context. As she did, we can't just look at it in terms of, like I was saying before the clip, if someone is incarcerated, it automatically means, we're going to stigmatize them with this label as a criminal and not think further into the state or the legal state of this country, the economic system that we've discussed, being capitalism and the reasons why it's necessary to have these laws on the books and, criminalize more and more people so they can increase their profit. And so I think that, she's speaking about this issue in a much larger context of looking at it in terms of how this is affecting society. And, she didn't directly speak about recidivism rate, but that's what she was talking about too, is that, the more we allow people to live under these incredible, inhumane conditions and then come out, it's a cycle where people are going to continue going back or are going to be out and they're not going to be rehab, like they're not going through rehab. They're, women or men who have drug addictions aren't going to, come out and no longer have this addiction. It's actually most likely going to be worse, and then psychologically they're going to be so damaged from the conditions that they were in that, they might commit other crimes. And so I think that, zooming out and thinking about things in a different, in all the different contexts that it deserves to be looked at is really essential. I really appreciated that from her clip. And I think that what she was talking about at the end about having you know, and I think it was not just this issue, but since we're talking about this issue particularly, if people really want to get involved in a specific societal problem, knowing that, you know, you have to go in into whatever environment with a really open mind and ready to, like, know that no one can tell you more about a specific condition than the people who are living that condition. And so I think that, you know, her approach to creating change and awareness and education around the prison industrial complex and having students be taught by prisoners is incredible.
Right. And, you know, and you mentioned the recidivism rate. You know, when you have a prison industrial complex that is fueled by capitalism, that is based on, you know, bottom line, based on you know, Corrections Corporation of America and GEO Group, formerly known as Wackenhut, you know, you can find them on the you know, you can find them on the on, you know, on Wall Street, you know, and you know, they have an index ticker, the whole nine. It just, you know, folks, I mean, it should jump out at us that, you know, there is a conflict of interest when it comes. I mean, it doesn't behoove them to you know, to really, you know, reform these individuals, to, you know, if they need reforming at all. I mean, the system needs reforming, I think, way more than, you know, most people that are locked up. And we know 2/3 of the people at least that are locked up are in there for nonviolent offenses. But, you know, there's no way in hell. I mean, they don't want to reform people. I mean, they want to make them into bigger, badder criminals. I mean, you have folks that come in there. You know, I know, you know, comrades of mine that have been locked up, and they have gone in as nonviolent offenders and come out very, very violent, because it was a situation where they were just in inhumane conditions, and, you know, in their words, without mincing their words in any shape, form, or fashion, they said, you know, it's either, you know, eat or be eaten, or either kill or be killed, you know, and you know, they're inhumane conditions. When you look at other countries, the recidivism rates are much lower, because they're actually trying to rehabilitate individuals and then incorporate them back into society. I mean, they say, you know, hey, you've done your time, you know, you went through all these different programs, and now you're ready to be, you know, reentered into society, and we want our crime levels down because it improves our society, and, you know, we don't want, you know, you did your time, so that shouldn't serve as any kind of anchor or encumbrance preventing you from getting a job, or preventing you from voting. But here we have right here in America, you know, you do times, you could do a 15-year bid, and you get out. I mean, you've served your debt to society, so-called, and you get out, Andrea, and you can't vote in a lot of places, and it is hell trying to find a job. I mean, I work, you know, do a lot of volunteer work, as you know, in the prison system, and. It's hell for these individuals to find work when they get out after they've done. It's hell, but it's, as you know, Andre, that is part of the traps that are set out there. They want it to be hell, because when it's hell to find a job, Andre, when it's hell to find a job, it means that individuals will have no other choice, or little to no choice, but to turn to, you know, you know, burglary or breaking and entering, you know, to sustain themselves in this just rapacious capitalist environment that we all live in. And so, boom, you get pinched again. So this time, if you did a 15-year bid before, this time you're doing 25 to 30. You're doing 25 to 30. You know, and it goes on and on and on. This happens, and so the recidivism rate in this country is upwards of 70%. That's sick. It's disgusting. It's sick. But what would we expect from a system that is based on profit? And Corrections Corporation of America, they build prisons, they build jails, they build detention centers for you know, for so-called illegal immigrants. They build juvenile detention centers. You name it. I mean, they're everywhere. And yes, they are in Southeast D.C., CCA, you know, and one of the prisons that one of the jails that I do some work in. Yes, they D.C. jail. They own that, if you will. And D.C. jail has some of the worst conditions I've ever seen in any jail or prison that I've been in. So, you know, Andrea, you're right. She paints a broad picture, and yeah, what better people to work with? I mean, you know, I mean those folks that have been products of this system, they know better than anybody what needs to be reformed, what it would take to be reformed. I mean, it's just like, you know, you have all these, you know, so-called activists out there that are doing stuff for, like, homeless people, and, oh, you know, we got to do this for homeless people. And very, very few activists actually go out there and sit down and do, you know, empirical, you know, research and interviews directly, one-on-one with homeless people and asking them, hey, what do you need? You know, what do you think is needed to provide you more support? You know, I remember hearing this guy who's one of the name eludes me, but has written many books on homelessness in America, and has done, you know, speaking on all these different panels. And he even said it. He said most of these panels I go to, and I start to talk to, you know, other folks who are involved in you know, working on behalf of homeless people. Most of them have not spent any time, you know, on the street, you know, interviewing, talking to homeless people. And he's like, I interviewed 1,000 people, and my first question was like, hey, you know, what would you need? I mean, what kind of support would help you? You know, so you know, I appreciate the work that Sammy is doing and the work that other folks are doing around this. And I tell you, Michelle Alexander's book, if people haven't read it, I mean, you pick it up. Pick it up. I mean, that's a great book. Same thing with Douglas Blackman's book, Slavery by Another Name. But Michelle Alexander's book is, I mean, it's undeniable. I mean, it's well-referenced, well-written, you know, it's just, it's undeniable. The stats and data are all in there, and it's written in a style that, I mean, it's a very, very important text. But one thing, you know, that you know, you mentioned, Andrea, to talk about the broader context, is that what's interesting, and I want to play this clip, Andrea, is where we spoke about Eddie Conaway, you know, in this interview, Benjamin mentioned the great, wonderful human being George Jackson was. Folks, pick up Blood in My Eye. Please pick up that book. I'm staring at it. It's looking me right in the face right now, you know, in the studio, you know, Blood in My Eye. But, you know, there are so many political prisoners, so many black political prisoners that are behind bars right now. There are, you know, as well as, you know, Native American political prisoners like Leonard Peltier, but there's so many black political prisoners. And what's interesting, you have all these activists, and I'm talking about like white liberals who have, you know, raised the clarion call to Bradley Manning. And yes, that is a crime within itself, that this guy is in solitary confinement for, you know, for potentially, you know, allegedly leaking, you know, information to WikiLeaks, important information that has provided us a deeper context of the crimes that the U.S. military has and continues to commit, crimes against humanity. But, you know, I don't, you know, you simply just don't see a lot of those same activists raising raising the issue loud and direct, because, you know, you want to talk solitary confinement. You could talk about the Angola Three, who have been in solitary confinement for over 3 decades. You talk about Eddie Conaway, you talk about Chip Fitzgerald. I mean, we can go on and on. Sundi Alkoli. I mean, we can go Matula Shakur. We can go on and on. So I want to play this clip and to provide a little context and, you know, get your feedback on the other end. And if anyone is listening, I see a lot of folks in our chat room. If you want to
call in. You know, it's 347-945-5191. Once again, it's 347-945-5191. You're more than welcome to call in and give your input on this important issue.
As long as we continue to allow the United States to function as an empire, it will. And as long as it treats many of its own citizens as subjects, it is likely to impose that same status on those abroad. And to the extent that domestic struggles and the punished survivors of those struggles are ignored, efforts to change the country's impact in the world will suffer. Until there is massive unrest and protest aimed at the treatment of the indigenous, black, brown, and poor, until there are flotillas headed to Pelican Bay and flotillas to Pine Ridge, claims of solidarity with the rest of the world will remain as hollow as claims of progress here. It is unfortunate the extent to which this political disconnect exists. And one need only look at the example of Bradley Manning, the accused and imprisoned deliverer of government secrets to WikiLeaks, and the ways in which his case is so rarely connected to pre-existing cases of political imprisonment and torture to see how far that gap really is. So much could be learned were his treatment put in the context of, for instance, the Scott sisters, or even the longer-standing cases of Leonard Peltier, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Sundiata Okoli, or the Move 9. Failures to do so hampers a deeper understanding of this country, its impact in the world, and what it will take to change it. Earlier this month at the Socialism 2011 conference in Chicago, constitutional and civil rights lawyer Glenn Greenwald gave an impressive talk that explored the consequences of Barack Obama's increasingly imperial presidency and the shortcomings of the progressive political left. According to Greenwald, Obama's track record on civil liberties and the so-called war on terror demonstrates a strict continuation of Bush and Cheney policies, and yet so much of the left obediently defends the man and his party. Greenwald also pointed out, importantly, that because of the president's deft use of symbol, packaging, and rhetoric, he is able to disguise what is becoming an increasingly serious threat to civil liberties and human rights. For Greenwald, the mission creep and shifting of targets from so-called terrorists to U.S. citizens is becoming too easy, conducted under too much secrecy, and leading to an end of privacy and supposed claims of intellectual and political freedoms. But despite his principled and accurate concern over these shifting targets, Greenwald himself demonstrated a dangerous myopia, one that continues to threaten the development of progressive movements that he and those like him wish to see. Greenwald said that he was among the first to investigate and write about Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks because they had been described vaguely by the New York Times as threats to national security. This, said Greenwald, was enough for him to become suspicious and think that Manning and WikiLeaks deserved some assistance. But being the principled man he is, Greenwald and others like him, should now then apply that same standard to the dozens upon dozens of political prisoners whose imprisonment predates that of Manning's by decades. Following the same logic applied to Bradley Manning would greatly help the existing movement to free political prisoners get more attention and more resources. And who better than they, those who have long been considered threats to national security, to develop analyses needed to make real change? Perhaps this would help other well-meaning people like David House, founder of the Bradley Manning Support Committee, from having to admit, as he did last week, that it was the Manning case that awakened him to what this country could do. The brave prisoners now risking their lives to stop the daily torture they suffer in Pelican Bay and prisons around the country are the antecedents of Bradley Manning. And the specifically political prisoners who continue to exist as such also continue to illustrate the national mooring to an imperialism that Greenwald and others seem somehow new to. And this is why we support the work of those like the Black is Back Coalition, the Jericho Movement, and the Freedom Archives for their consistent reminder of the other wars, those waged against domestic liberation struggles and the captives that remain as a result, those whose liberties were first to be taken before those now slowly being dwindled. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Jared Ball. Online, visit us at blackagendareport.com.
Yeah, Andre, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it's a very important point that he made, and that, you know, we have to be consistent in how we apply, you know, our judgment across the board, and it has to be, you know, it, just because it's occurring to a particular person now, it's not okay to dismiss what's been happening for decades to another group of people. And so I think that it's refreshing to see that that perspective is being put out there.
Right, right, definitely. And speaking of a longtime political prisoner who has one of the most brilliant and precious minds, this generation and even before, and perhaps this world has ever known. I want to go to this brother, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and hear what he has to say about something related, regarding drugs and taxes.
Drugs and taxes. Usually, when an ex-president speaks, the nation listens. Of course, it may depend on what he says, but that's a general rule, given the status of U.S. presidents. Apparently, that's over. For days ago, former President Jimmy Carter called for an end to the drug war, pronouncing it a failure. This made radio news, but few of the TV networks felt it newsworthy. Surely the national mania on Wienergate may have played some part, but also a media establishment addicted to sensationalism loves the overflow from the drug war, the violence, the money, and mass fascination. It makes good ratings. But in Mexico, drugs have destroyed the state by violence, corruption, and the flood of money. If anyone doubts these assertions, I invite you to read To Die in Mexico by John Gibler, newly published by City Light's Open Media Series. Gibler, who lives and writes in Mexico and California, talked to Mexican journalists in several parts of the country and rolled with them on their death calls, that is, when bodies were found, which are freakishly frequent. He reveals a nation corrupt from its highest levels to its lowest, where narcos hire government forces to do their dirty work. As for the media, one journalist, Javier Valdez Cardenas, said openly of journalism in Culiacan, the narcos control the newsroom. Narcos is shorthand for powerful, wealthy drug cartels who virtually own police forces, mayors, governors, the National Assembly, and, reportedly, the president. Those they can't buy off, they kill. Indeed, the nation's most notorious cartel, the Zetas, the Spanish term for the letter Z, were originally U.S.-trained police and military who sold their services to the Sinaloa cartel. When they tired of working for others, they cut out the middlemen and formed their own drug cartel. Their reach extends to all levels of Mexican society, and they have imposed an aura of silence and fear. Simply put, the drug wars are killing Mexico from top to bottom, from end to end. It is a failure on a colossal scale. And as it has failed there, it failed here as well. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And Andreas, I thought that was, apropos to play that because, as we look at, the discussion we had with Benjamin, we talked about, or he mentioned the fact, how do all these drugs get into the black community? How did so many different kinds of drugs, heroin, cocaine, crack, get into the U.S. in the first place? And we know, we look at the derivation of how, crack found its way into the black community and how the CIA, FBI, U.S. government was complicit in that in terms of supporting and financing and facilitating those drugs by using federal agents to go into black communities in Southern California to sell these drugs within the black community. And this is all outlined. If you haven't read, the Dark Alliance book by Gary Webb, please, pick it up. It's damning evidence. I mean, it's really little to deny, it's well referenced, and he just, painstakingly put a lot of time and effort into, the information within that book. But we look and with this scumbag that's president of Mexico, Jose Calderon,
And I really hope he loses. I mean, they believe the election is next year. And, you know, Obrador, who is the real people's champion, and much like the 2000 election, Obrador most likely won the last election against Calderon, and it was stolen, you know. But he's the people's champion, and hopefully, you know he can win this election. I know he is running again. So, you know, I don't know if you have any comments on that, Andre. I mean, you know all too well. I mean, how the whole war on drugs has even affected the continent which you come from, you know, South America, and specifically, Colombia and obviously Bolivia, and, the whole war on drugs, and which has been a war on people, has been a war on coca farmers and really facilitated, the building of more U.S. bases in that region of the world. Am I right?
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think it's just an extension of the military-industrial complex. It's another way to make money. And so, with Plan Colombia, it's just been a way for the U.S. to give financial aid to Colombia, to the Colombian government, to spend on U.S. corporations to buy weapons and fumigation chemicals from Monsanto to airplanes to uniforms. And so it's really just a business plan, a negotiation. It has nothing to do with ending the demand in the U.S. for drugs, preventing the production of cocaine or of coca, and then even preventing it from being transported into the U.S. It's actually increased production since 1995, I think, is when Bill Clinton passed Plan Colombia. Cocaine production has increased in Colombia, and they've implemented a similar plan in Mexico, and the only thing that we've seen come out of both is an increase in violence in both countries. In Colombia, we saw the false positives under President Uribe. In the 4 years or the 8 years that he was in presidency, just using poor people and then, killing them and dressing them in the uniforms of guerrillas and sending that as evidence of, this successful war on drugs because they were supposedly killing guerrillas, and now it is evident that it was actually a massacre on a number of poor people, indigenous people, Afro-Colombians, and we see the same thing happening in Mexico now. And so I think that we keep mentioning this, but really the root of it is about making money. It's about capital, about capitalism. And to think otherwise is just ignorant, and you really you don't care about people's lives. And if you look at the distribution of the money that Colombia receives from the U.S., I think like maybe 1% is used in social/educational programs. Everything else is used for military and police operations and funding, they're making sure that they have the guns and the planes and the chemicals supposedly, to end this war on drugs. But we've seen the result of just people being displaced. Colombia has, if not first, the second largest internal displaced population in the world. And this influx of people from the countryside and out, from towns outside of Bogota to Colombia is creating a very tense situation in Bogota, where so many people are unemployed and have no other options. And then having the whole market of other, food and produce being just completely obliterated because, you know, if you're in the countryside, there's no way that you can have a subsistence for your family by growing yucca or rice or plantains. It's just, it's not viable because there's not, you know, you don't have the infrastructure, you don't have the transportation, you know, and so, but people are willing to transport coca. You know, there's always a way to get coca across, and besides, it's much easier to transport bricks of cocaine than, you know, like different types of produce. And so I would just suggest that, you know, people check out some of the work of San Ho Tree from the Institute of Policy Studies. There's a lot of good work around Mexico, Afghanistan, and Colombia and explaining and breaking down how, you know, this supposed war on drugs is just a perpetual attack on, you know, both people who, you know, receive these drugs in the U.S. as well as people who are forced into either growing coca or are being displaced by the effects of this war on drugs in Colombia and in Mexico.
Yeah, and then another great site. I mean, I really, you know, implore folks to go to narconews.com. You know, that's a well-detailed website where you can go there and I mean, it's broken down. You know, it's you know, just go to narco narconews.com, narconews.com, and I mean, it breaks down. You know, everything from, you know, U.S.-trained assassin teams that are currently now deployed in Mexico. We know now in Mexico City they've set up, you know, they've set up, you know, a DA office that is, like, you know, masked, you know, almost in my plain sight. And, yeah, it's so, you know, definitely, you know, check, because, hey, why does it matter? Because, hey, yeah, it's, if you're listening right now and you're a U.S. taxpayer, your taxpayers, you know, your taxpayer dollars go towards this, and the number one customer for these illicit drugs, whether they're coming from Colombia or Bolivia, you know what I'm saying, you know, Mexico, or if they're, you know, being funneled through the Caribbean. I mean, we know that it's not just, you know, in South America, it's in Central America. I mean, it's in the Caribbean. The number one, you know, customer are Americans. Americans are what keep the you know, they keep the market going, you know. And when you look at the drug policy here in the U.S., It should be no surprise whatsoever, you know. And poor people can't go to drug courts. Poor people can't access high-priced lawyers to get them into the drug courts in the first place, to advocate getting them in the drug courts. Poor people don't get sent to don't routinely get sent to drug rehabilitation centers like Leavenworth, you know, where they can actually go in there be rehabilitated off heroin and cocaine, you know, and other illicit drugs, addictive, you know, deadly drugs. You know, they don't get access to that. What poor people get, they get sent to San Quentin. They get sent to, you know what I'm saying, they get sent to Folsom. They get sent to you know, places in Montana, you know, far away from their families. You know, so if they're in Southeast D.C., I mean, I know brothers who, you know, are serving time in federal prisons in places, you know, that are from D.C. that are now in, you know, in prisons, in federal prisons in places like Montana. Like, are you kidding me? You know what I'm saying? So, it's right here. And so, we're fueling it, you know. The American populace, I mean, is fueling this war on so-called war on drugs, you know, which is really to nothing but a guise, you know, for this capitalist structure to continue to perpetuate a very successful profit-making apparatus known as the prison industrial complex, and also known as who benefits from, you know, because we know that this drug money has also made its way to Wall Street, Andrea, and it has made its way his ways into the coffers of hedge fund, you know, managers, and that has been detailed in some articles, some write-on articles that have been featured in places like Daily Censored. But what kind of show would it be without us closing out to play this? I want to play this clip. We started off, you know, talking about, you know, the president of the U.S., otherwise known as Barack Hussein Obama. But I want to play this clip. This will be the last clip we play, and I'm going to get your comments on this, Andrea, on the other end. You know, yes, we're going to overtime. This is like a game tied. We're going into overtime. But I really want to play this clip because it's hot. It's relevant, and Andrea, I want to once again get your feedback to take us home.
A friend of mine is struggling to get an early court date so she can save her home from seizure by bankster criminals before Barack Obama sells her out. My friend is among the hundreds of thousands of homeowners whose purported signatures appear on documents they never saw, much less signed. She has an affidavit from handwriting experts to prove it, and in her case, the forger even spelled her name wrong. The corporate media like to call this robo-signing, where banks invent documents to prove they legally own the properties they're trying to seize. It's a bad choice of words that tends to say that inhuman machines are the culprits, when in fact we're witnessing a multi-billion dollar criminal enterprise at work. Wall Street banker criminality so blatant it makes Wyatt Earp's Dodge City look like a Florida retirement community. The crime spree that was central to the housing bubble was a nasty mess, with banksters so busy fleecing home buyers and turning bad paper into AAA securities, they created a paper processing scheme that neglected to include all the proper documents proving ownership. The heist was quick, ultimately bagging hundreds of billions, but it was legally sloppy. The robo-signers were brought in to clean up the crime scene, but only deepened the banker's culpability with another layer of fraud that is now exposed for all the world to see. By any legal and ethical standard, the bank's conduct is criminal and indefensible. They need to pay through the nose and fill up the jails. But they've got the President of the United States in their pocket. Obama, who my friend voted for, has put together a financial settlement that would forgive the bankers for all their crimes. Crimes of the past, no doubt including crimes such as repossessions that are continuing right now and crimes that are yet to be discovered. All for the paltry sum of $20 billion, a pittance for an industry that receives $16 trillion in the people's funds under President Obama, and has benefited in trillions more in free money from the Federal Reserve. For a measly $20 billion, the bankers buy a get-out-of-jail card and get to keep their ill-gotten gains in perpetuity, a whitewashing of crime on an unprecedented scale. When my friend heard about Obama's dirty dealing, she knew she needed to force the issue in court before the first black president gave immunity and a go-ahead card to the banksters who forged her name in order to steal her home. Certainly, many other victims of the Wall Street Mafia are also banging on the court's doors, hoping to get some chance for justice before the presidential fix is in. What a spectacle. Once, all 50 state attorneys general vowed to put bankster criminality in check. Today, only 4 are left, most notably New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, and 3 of the rest are shaky. But the banks are still balking at the settlement, demanding ironclad assurances that they can never be made accountable for their robo-signing crimes. That's why my friend is trying to beat the clock and get her day in court before big money and Barack Obama shut the doors on justice forever. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Andrea, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't think you can get any more clear than that. You know, if people don't see the relationship between you know, having this image of, you know, someone carrying a dime bag and that being a reason enough for them to go to jail for 5 years versus, you know, a group of individuals through a corporation stealing people's houses. I mean, you know, I feel like it's essential that as a community we really start to make these comparisons, because, I mean, I'm just thinking, like, from perspective, like, the things that I hear and just, like, the mentality of people that you interact with daily, or even just, like, watching TV and the shows that are out there, or even the so-called news where, you know, like, everyday people who might be, you know, occasional drug users are completely criminalized, or somebody that steals someone's purse. You know, it's not to justify that or to say that if you're dealing drugs, like, that's something productive to society. I understand that. But if you put it on an equal, you know, level and you can make these comparisons, they're just completely different. But somehow we don't see white-collar crime as you know, criminal as somebody stealing your purse, you know. But it's okay that they steal hundreds of thousands of people's houses, you know. I mean, I think that it's important that, you know, we really start thinking about these things. And I think, you know, Glenn's piece was really essential in bringing that out.
Yeah, without a doubt. It's, you know, corporate crimes, you know, get you oftentimes, you know, it's only once in a blue moon where you will see, you know, the Michael Melkins, the Ivan Boskys, and the like, you know, the Kenneth Lays, get their just due, where they're gonna, you know, do some, you know, quote unquote hard time. You know, a lot of them, these cats like Milken and Bosky, I mean, they, you know, get sent to resort type prisons, you know.
Right.
But it's far and few between. You know, these folks, it's economic terrorism. I mean, to steal something from Max Kaiser, and he always says, I mean, he calls them, you know, they're economic terrorists. They are without a doubt unrepentant, you know, rapacious economic terrorists, and they're wreaking havoc on everyone that they can, and, you know, to increase their damn bottom line. And, you know, they have ruined countless lives, Andrea, countless lives. I mean, this whole debacle, the credit default swaps, the speculations on derivatives and packaging, you know, these mortgage loans, you know, in the first place, even preying upon, you know, poor people who they knew cannot, you know, who are going to be unable to pay these things, their monthly mortgage payments when the arm expands, you know, to double, triple, quadruple of what they had initially been paying. I mean, it is high crime it is sick, because, Andrea, you could say, like, hey, if I went and broke into your house, Andrea, and stole your TV, and if you had a safe in there, either a couple thousand dollars, you know, stored up in your safe or under your mattress, and I stole that, all right, you know, I'm putting you out, you know, maybe 2-3 G's, right? Now these folks, the impact, and so, you know, Lord knows me as a black man, what kind of time I'm probably going to do for that. But, you know, these folks, I mean, they're destroying lives at the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, we're talking about people's homes that are probably, you know, anywhere from $100,000, maybe, you know, some homes being $100,000, some homes being $200,000-$300,000. And we're talking about, I mean, so we're talking about the lives that are affected by these individuals. And why, Andre, why are these corporate crimes,
why are these corporate crimes not prosecuted to the same extent that we see, you know, the proliferation of cops, you know, wearing their you know their you know heavy hand and iron fist on black and brown communities. I mean, is it, you know, is it a combination of institutional racism and white supremacy and with the backdrop of capitalism? I mean, I think that's obvious. I mean, there's two standards. There's a double set of for those that have money. I mean, those that have money can, you know, oftentimes can slick and slither their slimy, you know, scumbaggish ways, you know, out of the selective long arm of the law. So I don't know if you have anything else to say before we adjourn, but I give you the floor.
I just want to say that I want to wish you a blessed and happy upcoming birthday on behalf of Your World News and all our listeners that I'm sure appreciate all the work that you do around everything we've been talking about today. Like you mentioned, you volunteer in the jails and even had being the founder and the host of this program. And so I hope that you're blessed with many, many more decades with health and your family to be able to continue to do the work that you've been doing.
Thank you. And the best way, you know, to wish me a happy birthday, folks, is to do the work that needs to be done. I mean, that's the best birthday gift that I can, you know, ask from anybody is to give your time and body and sacrifice to those folks that need the need, you know, our assistance. Those of us that are in more privileged positions, those of us that are in less vulnerable positions, whether you're a professor, whether you're, I don't know, whether you're, you know, a teacher, or you know, you work in you're a social worker, what have you, you know, find a way to get involved. I mean, it's good to listen to these shows, and we support, we appreciate your support, because this show is not making us any money, but this show is for the community. So, you know, spread the word, spread the information, but also, you know, set the standard. Serve as that, that example to your peers, to your family, to the community, so they can see you, you know, out there in the community, doing the work that needs to be done. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done. If we can continue to build our critical mass, I'm trying to tell you, if we can continue to build our critical mass, we can do this together. We can have a real paradigm shift and shift things from this corrupt, racist system, you know, that we live under, that so many people are suffering, so many people who have lost their lives unjustly. That is the best birthday gift that we can give ourselves collectively as a community. And, you know, and that's the best way we can honor the likes of Dr. King, Malcolm X, Daniel Hamer, you know, Ella Baker, and so many others, Ricardo Falcón, you know, Cesar Chavez, you know. I mean, we can just go on and on of folks who really played a major role. And, you know, that's my birthday wish. You know, let's just get involved. So let's take us out. Hey. Let's talk about, you know, you talk about Lupe Fiasco, his first album. This is a song that wasn't played on his first album, and it's simply known as American Terrorist. If you never heard the song before, listen closely. For Andrea Zamudio, I am Solomon. This is Your World News, and most importantly, this is Your World News. Your World News. This is your channel. You know, this is your show. This is the people's show. Spread the word. Let's build this informed minds and which is going to be towards motivation and organization. Yeah, we can. All right, take care.
Hey. blood of a mob. We came through the storm, nooses on our necks, and a smallpox blanket to keep us warm. On a 747 on the Pentagon lawn, wake up, the alarm clock is connected to a bomb. Anthrax lab on a West Virginia farm. Shorty ain't learned to walk, already heavily armed. Civilians and little children is especially harmed. Camouflage Taurus, Bibles and glorious Quran. The books that take you to heaven and let you meet the Lord there have become misinterpreted reasons for warfare. Reread them with blind eyes, I guarantee you there's more there. Rich must be blind, cause they ain't see the poor. Need to open up a park, just close 10 schools. We don't need them. Can you please call the fire department? They down here marching for freedom. Burn down ATVs, turn ATVs on the teacher. Let's move. The more money that they make, the more money that they make, the better and better they live. Whatever they wanna say, whatever they wanna say, whatever, whatever it is. The more that you wanna learn, the more that you try to learn, the better and better it gets. America, yeah. Now the poor Ku Klux Man see that we all brothers, not cause things the same, because we lack the same color, and that's gray. Now that's cause he can't afford the gasoline. Now if a Muslim woman trapped with a bomb on the bus, with the seconds running, give you the jitters. Just imagine an American-based Christian organization planning to poison water supplies to bring the second coming quicker. Nigga, they ain't living properly. Wreck them all for no democracy. Turn their whole culture to a mockery. Give them Coca-Cola for their prophecy. Give them gum, give them guns, get them young, give them fun. But if they ain't giving it up, then they ain't getting none. And don't give them all, no, man, give them some. It's the paper, some of these cops must be Al-Qaeda, nigga. The more money that they make, the more money that they make, the better and better. Give them pen, make them pull gold from river. Give black man crack, block and things. Give red man crack, slot machines. I bring it back, 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 bring it back. Don't give the black man food, give the red man liquor. Red man food, black man nigga. Give yellow man.